Duchess. I was in high spirits. That's my excuse. All day I'd been hopscotching from one pleasant surprise to the next. First, I'd been given the run of Wooly's sister's house and ended up with a fine set of threads. I'd had a nice visit with Ma Bell and the girls. Against all odds, Emmett had shown up, giving me the chance, with Charity's help, to perform my third good deed in as many days. And now, here I was sitting behind the wheel of a 1941 Cadillac heading into Manhattan with the top down. The only wrench in the works was that Wooly and I had ended up with Billy in tow. When Emmett had shown up at Ma Bell's, it hadn't occurred to me for one second that he had brought along his brother, so I was a little surprised to find him at Wooly's side. Don't get me wrong, Billy was a sweet kid, as far as kids go, but he was also something of a know-it-all. And if know-it-alls are prone to get under your skin, no know-it-all gets under your skin like a young know-it-all. We hadn't even been together for an hour, and he'd already corrected me three times. First, it was to point out that the Sutter sisters hadn't been shooting each other with real guns, like I was the one who needed an introduction to the elements of stagecraft. Next, it was to point out that a seal is a mammal, not some kind of fish, because it has warm blood and a backbone and yada, yada, yada. Then, as we were driving onto the Brooklyn Bridge, with the skyline stretching before us in all its glory, and I happened to ask in my elevated state whether anyone could think of a single example in the history of mankind of a river crossing that felt more transformative, rather than quietly appreciating the poetry of the moment and the spirit of the remark, the kid, who's sitting in the back seat like a little millionaire, felt the necessity of chiming in. "I can think of an example," says he. "The question was rhetorical," says I, but now he's got Wooly intrigued.
"What's your example, Billy?"
"The crossing of the Delaware by George Washington. On Christmas night in 1776, General Washington crossed the river's icy waters to sneak up on the Hessians. Catching them unawares, Washington's troops routed the enemy and captured 1,000 prisoners. The event was memorialized in a famous painting by Emanuel Leutze."
"I think I've seen that painting," exclaimed Wooly. "Isn't Washington standing in the bow of a rowboat?"
"Nobody stands in the bow of a rowboat," I pointed out.
"In Emanuel Leutze's painting, Washington is standing in the bow of a rowboat," said Billy. "I can show you a picture if you'd like. It's in Professor Abernathy's book."
"Of course it is."
"That's a good one," said Wooly, who was always up for a bit of history.
As it was Friday night, there was some traffic, and we ended up coming to a stop at the top of the bridge, which provided us with the perfect opportunity to appreciate the view in silence.
"I know another one," said Billy.
Wooly turned toward the back seat with a smile.
"Which one, Billy?"
"When Caesar crossed the Rubicon."
"What happened that time?"
You could almost hear the kid sitting up in his seat.
"In 49 BC, when Caesar was the governor of Gaul, the Senate, which had become wary of his ambitions, recalled him to the capital, instructing him to leave his troops at the banks of the Rubicon. Instead, Caesar marched his soldiers across the river into Italy and led them straight to Rome, where he soon seized power and launched the imperial era. That's where the expression crossing the Rubicon comes from. It means passing a point of no return."
"Another good one," said Wooly.
"Then there was Ulysses, who crossed the river Styx."
"I think we get the idea," I said. But Wooly wasn't finished.
"What about Moses?" he asked. "Didn't he cross a river?"
"That was the Red Sea," said Billy. "It was when he was—"
No doubt the kid had intended to give us chapter and verse on Moses, but for once, he interrupted himself.
"Look," he said, pointing in the distance, "the Empire State Building."
All three of us turned our attention to the skyscraper in question, and that's when the idea hit me. Like a little bolt of lightning, it zapped me on the top of the head and sent a tingling sensation up and down my spine. "Isn't that where his office is?" I asked, peeking at Billy in the rearview mirror.
"Whose office?" asked Wooly.
"Professor Abercrombie's."
"You mean Professor Abernathy's?"
"Exactly. How does it go, Billy? I write to you from the junction of 34th Street and 5th Avenue on the Isle of Manhattan?"
"Yes," said Billy, his eyes opening wide. "That's how it goes."
"Then why don't we pay him a visit?" Out of the corner of my eye,
I could see that Wooly was disconcerted by my suggestion, but Billy wasn't.
"We can pay him a visit?" he asked.
"I don't see why not."
"Duchess," said Wooly.
I ignored him. "What's that he calls you in the introduction, Billy? Dear reader? What author wouldn't want to receive a visit from one of his dear readers? I mean, writers must work twice as hard as actors, right? But they don't get any standing ovations or curtain calls or people waiting outside the backstage door. Besides, if Professor Abernathy didn't want to receive visits from his readers, why would he have put his address on the first page of his book?"
"He probably wouldn't be there at this hour," countered Wooly.
"Maybe he's working late," I countered right back. As the traffic began to move again, I pulled into the right lane in order to take the uptown exit, thinking to myself that if the lobby wasn't open, we were going to climb that building like King Kong. Having headed west on 35th Street, I took the left onto 5th Avenue and pulled over right in front of the building's entrance. A second later, one of the doormen was on me.
"You can't park there, buddy."
"We're just gonna be a minute," I said, slipping him a five. "In the meantime, maybe you and President Lincoln can get to know each other." Now, instead of telling me where I couldn't park, he was opening Wooly's door and ushering us into the building with a tip of the hat. Capitalism, they call it. As we entered the lobby, Billy had a look of anxious excitement. He just couldn't believe where we were and what we were about to do. In his wildest dreams, he hadn't imagined it. Wooly, on the other hand, looked at me with a frown that was decidedly out of character. "What?" I said. Before he could answer, Billy was tugging at my sleeve.
"How will we find him, Duchess?"
"You know where to find him, Billy."
"I do?"
"You read it to me yourself."
Billy's eyes opened wide. "On the 55th floor."
"Exactly." With a smile, I gestured to the elevator bank.
"Are we taking the elevator?"
"We're certainly not taking the stairs." We boarded one of the express cars.
"I've never been in an elevator," Billy said to the operator.
"Enjoy the ride," the operator replied. Then he pulled the lever and sent us shooting up into the building. Normally, Wooly would have been humming a ditty on a ride like this, but I was the one who was doing the humming tonight. And Billy, he was quietly counting the floors as we passed them. You could tell by the movement of his lips.
51, he mouthed. 52, 53, 54.
At the 55th floor, the operator opened the doors and we disembarked. When we proceeded from the elevator bank into the hallway, we found rows of doors stretching to our left and right.
"What do we do now?" asked Billy.
I pointed to the nearest door. "We'll start there and work our way around the floor until we find him."
"Clockwise?"
Billy asked. "Anywise you like." So we set about going from door to door, clockwise, and Billy would read out the names that were etched on the little brass plaques, just like he'd called out the floors in the elevator, only this time out loud. It was quite a parade of paper pushers. In addition to attorneys and accountants, there were brokers of real estate, insurance, and stocks. Not from the big firms, you understand. These were the shops operated by the guys who couldn't make it in the big firms. The guys who resold their shoes and read the funny pages while waiting for the phone to ring. The first 20 shingles Billy read in a punchy, upbeat manner, like each one was a pleasant little surprise. The next 20 he read with a little less enthusiasm. After those, his delivery began to flag. You could almost hear the thumb of reality beginning to press down on that spot in the soul from which youthful enthusiasm springs. Reality was almost certainly going to leave its mark on Billy Watson tonight. And that mark was likely to stay with him for the rest of his life as a helpful reminder that while the heroes in storybooks are usually figments of the imagination, most of the men who write about them are figments of the imagination too. When we turned the fourth corner, we could see the last stretch of doors leading up to the spot where we'd begun. Slower and slower, Billy moved. Softer and softer, he spoke. Until finally, in front of the second-to-last door, he came to a stop and said nothing at all. He must have read out 50 little plaques by then, and though I was standing behind him, I could tell from his posture that he'd simply had enough. After a moment, he looked up at Wooly with what must have been an expression of disappointment on his face, because Wooly suddenly had an expression of sympathy on his. Then Billy turned to look at me. Only his expression wasn't of disappointment. It was of wide-eyed amazement. Turning back to the little brass plaque, he extended a finger and read the inscription out loud.
Office of Professor Abacus Abernathy, MLA, PhD.
Turning to Wooly with my own expression of amazement, I realized that the sympathy on his face hadn't been meant for Billy. It had been meant for me. Because once again, the feet I had pulled from the rug out from under were my own. After spending a few days with this kid, you'd think I might have known better. But like I said, I blame the high spirits. Well, when circumstances conspire to spoil your carefully laid plans with an unexpected reversal, the best thing you can do is take credit as quickly as possible. What'd I tell you, kid? Billy gave me a smile, but then he looked at the doorknob with a touch of apprehension, as if he weren't sure he had the gumption to turn it.
Allow me, exclaimed Wooly.
Stepping forward, Wooly turned the knob and opened the door. Inside, we found ourselves in a small reception area with a desk, coffee table, and a few chairs. The room would have been dark but for a faint light that shone through the open transom over an interior door.
I guess you were right, Wooly, I said with an audible sigh. Looks like nobody's home.
But Wooly raised a finger to his lips.
Shh! Did you hear that?
We all looked up when Wooly pointed at the transom.
There it is again, he whispered.
There's what?
I whispered back.
The scratching of a pen, said Billy. The scratching of a pen, said Wooly with a smile.
Billy and I followed Wooly as he tiptoed across the reception area and gently turned the second knob. Behind this door was a much bigger room. It was a long rectangle lined from floor to ceiling with books and furnished with a standing globe, a couch, two high-back chairs, and a large wooden desk, behind which sat a little old man writing in a little old ledger by the light of a green-shaded lamp. Wearing a wrinkled seersucker suit, he had thinning white hair and a pair of reading glasses perched on the tip of his nose. In other words, he looked so much the part of a professor, you had to figure that all the books on the shelves were for show. At the sound of our entry, the old man looked up from his work without a hint of surprise or dismay.
May I help you?
After the three of us had taken a few steps, Wooly nudged Billy one step more.
Ask him,
he encouraged. Billy cleared his throat.
Are you Professor Abacus Abernathy?
After moving his reading glasses to the top of his head, the old man tilted the shade of his lamp so that he could get a better look at the three of us. But mostly he trained his gaze on Billy, having understood in the instant that the boy was the reason we were there.
I am Abacus Abernathy, he replied. What can I do for you?
Although there seemed to be no end to the things that Billy knew, apparently what he did not know was what Abacus Abernathy could do for him. Because rather than give an answer, Billy looked back at Wooly with an unsure expression. So Wooly spoke on his behalf.
We're sorry to interrupt you, Professor, but this is Billy Watson from Morgan, Nebraska, who's just arrived in New York City for the very first time. He's only 8 years old, but he has read your compendium of adventurers 24 times.
Having listened to Wooly with interest, the professor shifted his gaze back to Billy.
Is that so, young man?
It is so, said Billy, except that I've read it 25 times.
Well, said the professor, if you have read my book 25 times, and have come all the way from Nebraska to New York City to tell me so, then the least I can do is offer you a chair.
With an open hand, he invited Billy to take one of the high-back chairs in front of his desk. For Wooly and me, he gestured to the couch by the bookcase. Let me say right now that it was a very nice couch. It was upholstered with dark brown leather, pinpointed with shiny brass rivets, and almost as big as a car. But if three people who come into a room accept a fourth person's offer of a seat, then no one's going anywhere anytime soon. It's human nature. Having taken all the trouble of making themselves comfortable, people are going to feel the need to chew the fat for at least half an hour. In fact, if they run out of things to say after 20 minutes, they'll start making them up just to be polite. So when the professor offered us the seats, I opened my mouth with every intention of observing that it was getting quite late, and our car was at the curb. But before I could get a word out, Billy was climbing onto the high-backed chair, and Wooly was settling into the couch.
"Now tell me, Billy," said the professor, once we were all irreparably ensconced, "what brings you to New York?"
As conversations go, it was a classic opener. It was the sort of question that any New Yorker would ask a visitor with a reasonable expectation of a one- or two-sentence reply, like, "I'm here to see my aunt," or, "We have tickets for a show." But this was Billy Watson, so instead of one or two sentences, what the professor got was the whole Megillah. Billy started back in 1946, on the summer night that his mother walked out on them. He explained about Emmett's doing the hitch at Salina, and his father dying of cancer, and the brothers' plan to follow the trail of a bunch of postcards so that they could find their mother at a fireworks display in San Francisco on the 4th of July. He even explained about the escapade, and how since Wooly and I had borrowed the Studebaker, he and Emmett had to hitch a ride to New York on the Sunset East.
"Well, well, well," said the professor, who hadn't missed a word. "And you say that you traveled to the city by freight train?"
"That's when I began your book for the 25th time," said Billy.
"In the boxcar?"
"There wasn't a window, but I had my army surplus flashlight."
"How fortuitous."
"When we decided to go to California and make a fresh start, Emmett agreed with you that we should only carry what we could fit in a kit bag, so I put everything I need in my backpack."
Having leaned back in his chair with a smile, the professor suddenly leaned forward again.
"You wouldn't happen to have the compendium in your backpack now?"
"Yes," said Billy. "That's just where I have it."
"Then perhaps I could inscribe it for you?"
"That would be terrific," exclaimed Wooly.
At the professor's encouragement, Billy slid off the high-back chair, took off his backpack, undid the straps, and removed the big red book.
"Bring it here," said the professor with a wave of the hand. "Bring it over here."
When Billy came around the desk, the professor took the book and held it under his light in order to appreciate the wear and tear.
"There are few things more beautiful to an author's eye," he confessed to Billy, "than a well-read copy of one of his books."
Setting the book down, the professor took up his pen and opened to the title page.
"It was a gift, I see."
"From Miss Matheson," said Billy. "She's the librarian at the Morgan Public Library."
"A gift from a librarian, no less," the professor said with added satisfaction.
Having written in Billy's book at some length, the professor applied his signature with a great big theatrical flourish, since when it comes to New York City, even the old guys who write compendiums perform for the back row. Before returning the book, the professor flitted once through the pages as if to make sure they were all there. Then, letting out a little expression of surprise, he looked at Billy.
"I see that you haven't filled in any of the U chapter. Now, why is that?"
"Because I want to start in medias res," explained Billy, "and I'm not sure yet where the middle is."
It sounded like a kooky answer to me, but it left the professor beaming.
"Billy Watson," he said, "as a seasoned historian and professional teller of tales, I think I can say with confidence that you have already been through enough adventures to warrant the beginning of your chapter. However," here the professor opened one of his desk drawers and took out a black ledger, just like the one that he'd been working in when we arrived, "should the 8 pages in your compendium prove insufficient for recording your story in its entirety, as I am almost certain they will, you can continue in the pages of this journal. And should you run out of pages in it, drop me a line, and I shall happily send you another."
Then, after handing over the 2 books, the professor shook Billy's hand and said what an honor it had been to meet him. And that, as they say, should have been that. But after Billy had carefully put away his books, cinched the straps on his backpack, and taken the first few steps toward the exit, he suddenly stopped, turned, and faced the professor with a furrowed brow, with which Billy Watson could only mean one thing: more questions.
"I think we've taken up enough of the professor's time," I said, laying a hand on Billy's shoulder.
"That's all right," said Abernathy.
"What is it, Billy?"
Billy looked at the floor for a second, then up at the professor.
"Do you think heroes return?"
"You mean like Napoleon returning to Paris? And Marco Polo returning to Venice?"
"No," said Billy, shaking his head. I don't mean returning to a place. I mean returning in time.
The professor was quiet for a moment.
Why do you ask that, Billy?
This go-round, the old scrivener definitely got more than he bargained for, because without taking a seat, Billy launched into a story that was longer and wilder than the first one. While he was on the Sunset East, he explained, and Emmett had gone looking for food, a pastor who'd invited himself into Billy's boxcar tried to take Billy's collection of silver dollars with the intention of tossing Billy from the train. In the nick of time, a big black guy dropped through the hatch, and it ended up being the pastor who got the old heave-ho. But apparently the pastor, the silver dollars, and the last-minute rescue weren't even the point of the story. The point was that the black guy, whose name was Ulysses, had left behind a wife and son when he crossed the Atlantic to fight in the war, and had been wandering the country on freight trains ever since. Now, when an 8-year-old boy is spinning a yarn like this one, with black men dropping through ceilings and pastors being thrown from trains, you might think it would test the limits of someone's willingness to suspend his disbelief, especially a professor's. But it didn't test Abernathy's in the least. As Billy told his story, the good professor resumed his seat in slow motion, carefully lowering himself into his chair, then gently leaning back, as if he didn't want a sudden sound or movement to interrupt the boy's story, or his own attention to it.
He thought he was named Ulysses for Ulysses S. Grant, said Billy, but I explained to him that he must be named for the great Ulysses, and that having already wandered for over 8 years without his wife and son, he was sure to be reunited with them once his 10 years of wandering were complete. But if heroes don't return in time, Billy concluded with a touch of concern, then maybe I shouldn't have said that to him.
When Billy stopped speaking, the professor closed his eyes for a moment. Not like Emmett does when he's trying to hold in his exasperation, but like a lover of music who has just heard the ending of his favorite concerto. When he opened his eyes again, he looked from Billy to the books along his walls and back again. I have no doubt that heroes return in time, he said to Billy. And I think you were perfectly right to tell him what you did. But I... Now it was the professor who looked at Billy with hesitation, and Billy who encouraged the professor to continue. I was just wondering, if this man called Ulysses is still here in New York?
Yes, said Billy. He is here in New York.
The professor sat for a moment, as if working up the courage to ask a second question of this 8-year-old.
I know it is late, he said at last, and you and your friends have other places to be, and I have no grounds on which to ask for this favor. But is there any chance that you might be willing to bring me to him?
Wooly.
It was on a trip to Greece with his mother in 1946, while standing at the foot of the Parthenon, that Wooly first gained an inkling of the list, that itemization of all the places that one was supposed to see.
There it is, she had said, while fanning herself with her map when they had reached the dusty summit overlooking Athens.
The Parthenon in all its glory. In addition to the Parthenon, as Wooly was soon to learn, there were the Piazza San Marco in Venice, and the Louvre in Paris, and the Uffizi in Florence. There were the Sistine Chapel, and Notre Dame, and Westminster Abbey. It was something of a mystery to Wooly where the list came from. It seemed to have been compiled by various scholars and eminent historians long before he was born. No one had ever quite explained to Wooly why one needed to see all the places on the list, but there was no mistaking the importance of doing so. For his elders would inevitably praise him if he had seen one, frown at him if he expressed disinterest in one, and chastise him in no uncertain terms if he happened to be in the vicinity of one and failed to pay it a visit. Suffice it to say, when it came to seeing items on the list, Wooly Wolcott Martin was Johnny on the spot. Whenever he traveled, he took special care to obtain the appropriate guidebooks and secure the services of the appropriate drivers to get him to the appropriate sites at the appropriate times.
To the Colosseum, signori, and step on it, he would say,
and off they would zip through the crooked streets of Rome with all the urgency of policemen in pursuit of a gang of thieves. Whenever Wooly arrived at one of the places on the list, he always had the same threefold response. First was a sense of awe, for these were not your run-of-the-mill stopping spots. They were big and elaborate, and fashioned from all sorts of impressive materials like marble
and mahogany and lapis lazuli. Second was a sense of gratitude toward his forebears, since they had gone to all the trouble of handing down this itemization from one generation to the next. But third and most important was a sense of relief. A relief that having dropped his bags at his hotel and dashed across the city in the back of a taxi, Wooly could check one more item off the list. But having considered himself a diligent checker-offer since the age of 12, earlier that evening when they were driving to the circus, Wooly had something of an epiphany. While the list had been handed down with consistency and care by five generations of Wolcotts, which is to say, Manhattanites, for some strange reason, it did not include a single site in the city of New York. And though Wooly had dutifully visited Buckingham Palace, La Scala, and the Eiffel Tower, he had never, ever, not even once, driven across the Brooklyn Bridge. Growing up on the Upper East Side, Wooly had had no need to cross it. To get to the Adirondacks or Long Island or any of those good old boarding schools up in New England, he would travel by way of the Queensboro or Triborough bridges. So after Duchess had driven them down Broadway and circled round City Hall, it was with a palpable sense of excitement that Wooly realized they were suddenly approaching the Brooklyn Bridge with every intention of driving across it. How truly majestic was its architecture, thought Wooly. How inspiring the cathedral-like buttresses and the cables that soared through the air. What a feat of engineering, especially since it had been built back in 18-something-something, and ever since had supported the movement of multitudes from one side of the river to the other and back again every single day. Surely the Brooklyn Bridge deserved to be on the list. It certainly had as much business being there as the Eiffel Tower, which was made from similar materials at a similar time, but which didn't take anybody anywhere. It must have been an undersight, decided Wooly, like his sister Caitlin and the oil paintings. When his family had visited the Louvre and the Uffizi, Caitlin had expressed the highest admiration for all those paintings lined along the walls in their gilded frames. As they walked from gallery to gallery, she was always giving Wooly the shush and pointing with insistence at some portrait or landscape that he was supposed to be quietly admiring. But the funny thing of it was that their townhouse on 86th Street had been chock full of portraits and landscapes in gilded frames, as had been their grandmother's. And yet in all those years of growing up, not once had he seen his sister stop in front of one of them in order to contemplate its majesty. That's why Wooly called it an undersight, because Caitlin didn't notice those oil paintings even though they were right under her nose. That must have been why the Manhattanites who'd handed down the list had failed to include any of the sights of New York, which, come to think of it, made Wooly wonder what else they'd forgotten. And then, just 2 hours later, when they were driving over the Brooklyn Bridge for a second time in one night, Billy stopped speaking mid-sentence in order to point in the distance. Look, he exclaimed, the Empire State Building. Well, that definitely belongs on the list, thought Wooly. It was the tallest building in the world. It was so tall, in fact, a plane had actually crashed into the top of it once. And yet, even though it was located right there in the middle of Manhattan, Wooly had never, ever, not even once, set foot inside. As such, when Duchess suggested they go there in order to pay a visit to Professor Abernathy, you might have expected Wooly to feel the same excitement that he'd felt when he realized they'd be driving over the Brooklyn Bridge. But what he felt was a pang of anxiety, a pang that stemmed not from the thought of riding a teeny little elevator up into the stratosphere, but from the tone of Duchess's voice, because Wooly had heard that tone before. He had heard it from three headmasters, and two Episcopal ministers, and a brother-in-law named Dennis. It was the tone that people used when they were about to set you straight. Now and then, it seemed to Wooly, in the course of your everyday life, you are likely to be blessed with a notion. Say, for instance, it's the middle of August, and you're drifting in your rowboat in the middle of the lake with the dragonflies skimming the water, when suddenly the thought occurs to you. Why doesn't summer vacation last until the 21st of September? After all, the season doesn't come to its conclusion on Labor Day weekend. The season of summer lasts until the autumnal equinox, just as surely as the season of spring lasts until the summer solstice. And look at how carefree everyone feels in the middle of summer vacation. not only the children, but the grown-ups too, who take such pleasure in having a tennis game at 10, a swim at noon, and a gin and tonic at 6 o'clock on the dot. It stands to reason that if we all agreed to let summer vacation last until the equinox, the world would be a much happier place. Well, when you have a notion like this, you have to be very careful in choosing whom you share it with. Because if certain people get wind of your notion, people like your headmaster or your minister or your brother-in-law Dennis, they are likely to feel it's their moral responsibility to sit you down and set you straight. Having gestured for you to take the big chair in front of their desk, they will explain not only how misguided your notion is, but how much better a person you're bound to be once you recognize this fact for yourself. And that was the tone that Duchess was using on Billy, the one that preceded the dispelling of an illusion. You can just imagine the satisfaction that Wooly felt, the jubilation even, when after elevating all the way up to the 55th floor, trudging down all the corridors and squinting at every little plaque, with only 2 more plaques to go, they came upon the one that read, Professor Abacus Abernathy, ABC, PhD, LMNOP. Poor Duchess, thought Wooly with a smile of sympathy. Maybe he's the one who will be learning a lesson tonight. As soon as they entered the professor's inner sanctum, Wooly could see that he was a sensitive man, a genial man, and even though he had a high-backed chair in front of a big oak desk, Wooly could tell that he was not the sort who would want to sit you down and set you straight. What's more, he was not the sort to hurry you along because time was money, or of the essence, or a stitch in nine, or what have you. When you are asked a question, even a question that on the surface seems relatively simple and straightforward, you may have to go quite a ways back in order to provide all the little details that will be necessary for someone to make sense of your answer. Despite this, there are many inquisitors who, as soon as you start providing these essential details, will start to make a face. They'll fidget in their seat. Then they'll do their best to hurry you along by pressing you to leap from point A to point Z while skipping all the letters in between. But not Professor Abernathy. When he asked Billy a deceptively simple question, and Billy went all the way back to the cradle in order to give a comprehensive reply, the professor leaned back in his chair and listened with the attentiveness of Solomon. So when Wooly and Billy and Duchess finally rose to take their leave, having visited 2 of the city's world-famous sites in a single night, check, check, and proven the irrefutable existence of Professor Abacus Abernathy, you might have thought that the night could not get any better. And you'd be wrong. 30 minutes later, they were all in the Cadillac, the professor included, driving down 9th Avenue to the West Side Elevated, another place of which Wooly had never heard.
You take that next right, said Billy.
As instructed, Duchess took the right onto a cobblestone street lined with trucks and meatpacking facilities. Wooly could tell they were meatpacking facilities because on one loading dock, 2 men in long white coats were carrying sides of beef off a truck, while over another was a large neon sign in the shape of a steer. A moment later, Billy told Duchess to take another right and then a left, and then he pointed to some wire caging rising from the street.
There, he said.
When Duchess pulled over, he didn't turn off the engine. On this little stretch, there were no more meatpackers and no more neon signs. Instead, there was an empty lot in which was parked a car without its wheels. At the end of the block, a lone silhouette, stocky and short, passed under a street lamp, then disappeared into the shadows.
Are you sure this is it? Duchess asked.
I'm sure this is it, said Billy, while slipping on his backpack.
Then just like that, he was out of the car and walking toward the caging. Wooly turned to Professor Abernathy in order to raise his eyebrows in surprise. But Professor Abernathy was already on his way to catch up with Billy. So Wooly leapt from the car in order to catch up with the professor, leaving Duchess to catch up with him. Inside the caging was a staircase of steel that disappeared overhead. Now it was the professor who looked to Wooly with his eyebrows raised, though more in excitement than surprise. Reaching out, Billy took hold of a patch of the fencing and began pulling it back.
Here, said Wooly. Allow me, allow me.
Extending his fingers through the mesh, Wooly pulled so that everyone could slip through. Then up the stairs they went, going round and round, their 8 feet clanging on the old metal treads. When they reached the top, Wooly pulled back another bit of fencing so that everyone could slip out. Oh, what amazement did Wooly feel when he emerged from the caging into the open air. To the south, you could see the towers of Wall Street, while to the north, the towers of Midtown. And if you looked very carefully to the south-southwest, you could just make out the Statue of Liberty. Another New York City landmark that surely belonged on the list and to which Wooly had never been.
Never been yet, Wooly pronounced in defiance to no one but himself.
But what was amazing about the elevated tracks wasn't the view of Wall Street or Midtown or even the great big summer sun that was setting over the Hudson. What was amazing was the flora. While they had been in Professor Abernathy's office, Billy had explained that they would be going to a segment of elevated railroad that had stopped being used 3 years before. But to Wooly's eye, it looked like it had been abandoned for decades. Everywhere you turned, there were wildflowers and shrubs, and the grass between the railroad ties had grown almost as high as their knees. In just 3 years, thought Wooly, why, that's less time than it takes to go to boarding school or to get a college degree. It's less time than a presidential term or the span between Olympics. Only 2 days before, Wooly had remarked to himself how terribly permanent Manhattan remained, despite being marched upon by millions of people every day. But apparently, it wasn't the marching of the millions that was going to bring the city to its end. It was their absence, for here was a glimpse of a New York left to itself. Here was a patch of the city upon which people had turned their backs for just a moment, and up through the gravel had come the shrubs and ivy and grass. And if this is what it was like just after a few years of disuse, thought Wooly, imagine what it will be like after a few decades. As Wooly looked up from the flora in order to share his observation with his friends, he realized that they had pressed ahead without him, working their way toward a campfire in the distance.
Wait up, he called. Wait up!
As Wooly rejoined his party, Billy was introducing the professor to a tall black man, the one named Ulysses. Though the two men had never met, both had learned something of the other from Billy, and when they shook hands, it struck Wooly that they did so with solemnity. A great and enviable solemnity.
Please, said Ulysses, as he gestured to the railroad ties around the fire, much as the professor had gestured to the couch and chair in his office.
When they had taken their seats, everyone was silent for a moment as the fire crackled and sparked. And it seemed to Wooly that he and Billy and Duchess were young warriors who had been given the privilege of witnessing the meeting between two tribal chiefs. But in the end, it was Billy who spoke first, encouraging Ulysses to tell his tale. After nodding at Billy, Ulysses turned his eyes to the professor and began. First, he explained how he and a woman named Macy, both alone in the world, had met in a dance hall in St. Louis, fallen in love, and been joined in holy matrimony. He explained how, when the war began, Macy had kept him close to her side as his able-bodied neighbors joined the fray, and how she had tightened her grip once she was radiant with child. He explained how, despite her warnings, he had enlisted, fought in Europe, and returned some years later to find that, good as her word, she and the boy had disappeared without a trace. Finally, he described how he had returned to Union Station that day, boarded the first train to anywhere, and been riding the rails ever since. And it was one of the saddest stories that Wooly had ever heard. For a moment, no one spoke. Even Duchess, who was always eager to follow someone else's story with a story of his own, kept his silence, sensing perhaps, as Wooly did, that something of great consequence was unfolding right before their eyes. After a few minutes, as if he had needed the moment of silence in order to gather himself, Ulysses continued.
I'm of the opinion, Professor, that everything of value in this life must be earned, that it should be earned, because those who are given something of value without having to earn it are bound to squander it. I believe that one should earn respect. One should earn trust. One should earn the love of a woman and the right to call oneself a man. And one should also earn the right to hope. At one time, I had a wellspring of hope, a wellspring that I had not earned. And not knowing what it was worth, on the day I left my wife and child, I squandered it. So over these last 8.5 years, I have learned to live without hope, just as surely as Cain lived without it once he entered the land of Nod.
To live without hope said Wooly to himself as he nodded his head and wiped the tears from his eyes. To live without hope in the land of Nod.
That is, said Ulysses, until I met this boy.
Without taking his gaze from the professor, Ulysses put a hand on Billy's shoulder.
When Billy said that as one named Ulysses, I might be destined to see my wife and child again, I felt a stirring within me. And when he read to me from your book, I felt it even more strongly. So much more strongly that I dared to wonder if, after all these years of traveling the country alone, I might finally have earned the right to hope again.
As Ulysses said this, Wooly sat up straighter. Earlier that day, he had tried to give his sister Sarah some sense of how a statement disguised as a question could be an ugly sort of thing. But beside the campfire, when Ulysses said to Professor Abernathy, I might finally have earned the right to hope again, Wooly understood that here was a question disguised as a statement. And Wooly found it to be beautiful. Professor Abernathy seemed to understand this as well, for after a moment of silence, he offered an answer. And as the professor spoke, Ulysses listened with the same deference that the professor had shown to him.
My life, such as it is, Mr. Ulysses, has been the opposite of yours in many respects. I have never been to war. I have not traveled this country. In fact, for most of the last 30 years, I've remained on the island of Manhattan. And for most of the last 10, I have remained in that.
Turning, the professor pointed to the Empire State Building.
There I have sat in a room surrounded by books, as insulated from the sounds of crickets and seagulls as from the reach of violence and compassion. If you are right, as I suspect you are, that what is valuable must be earned or it's bound to be squandered, then surely I am among the squanderers, one who has lived his life in the third person and the past tense. So let me start by acknowledging that anything I say to you, I say with the utmost humility.
Ceremoniously, the professor bowed his head to Ulysses.
But having confessed that I have lived my life through books, I can at least report that I have done so with conviction. Which is to say, Mr. Ulysses, that I have read a great deal. I have read thousands of books, many of them more than once. I have read histories and novels, scientific tracts, and volumes of poetry. And from all of these pages upon pages, one thing I have learned is that there is just enough variety in human experience for every single person in a city the size of New York to feel with assurance that their experience is unique. And this is a wonderful thing, because to aspire, to fall in love, to stumble as we do and yet soldier on, at some level we must believe that what we are going through has never been experienced quite as we have experienced it.
The professor turned his gaze from Ulysses so that he could make eye contact with everyone in the circle, including Wooly. But returning his gaze to Ulysses, the professor raised a finger in the air.
However, he continued, having observed that there is enough variety in human experience to sustain our sense of individuality in a locus as vast as New York, I strongly suspect that there is only just enough variety to do so. For were it in our power to gather up all the personal stories that have been experienced in different cities and townships around the world and across time, I haven't the slightest doubt that doppelgangers would abound. Men whose lives, despite the variation here and there, were just as our own in every material respect. Men who have loved when we loved, wept when we wept, accomplished what we have accomplished, and failed as we have failed. Men who have argued and reasoned and laughed exactly as we.
The professor looked around again.
Impossible, you say?
Though no one had said a word.
It is one of the most basic principles of infinity that it must, by definition, encompass not only one of everything, but everything's duplicate, as well as its triplicate. In fact, to imagine that there are additional versions of ourselves scattered across human history is substantially less outlandish than to imagine that there are none.
The professor turned his gaze back to Ulysses.
So, do I think it is possible that your life could be an echo of the life of the great Ulysses, and that after 10 years you could be reunited with your wife and son? I am certain of it.
Ulysses had taken in what the professor had said with the greatest gravity. Now he stood, and the professor stood, and the two clasped hands, each seeming to have found an unexpected solace from the other. But when the two men let their hands drop, and Ulysses turned, the professor took him by the arm and drew him back.
But there is something you need to know, Mr. Ulysses,
something that I didn't put in Billy's book. In the midst of his travels, when the great Ulysses visited the underworld and met the ghost of Tiresias, the old soothsayer told him that he was destined to wander the seas until he had appeased the gods through an act of tribute. Had Wooly been in Ulysses' position, upon hearing this additional piece of news, he would have felt a great sense of defeat. But Ulysses didn't seem to. Instead, he nodded his head at the professor, as if this was just as it should be. What act of tribute? What Tiresias tells Ulysses is that he must take up an oar and carry it into the countryside until he has reached a land so unfamiliar with the ways of the sea that a man in the road will stop and ask, "What is that you carry upon your shoulder?" At that spot, the great Ulysses was to plant the oar in the ground in Poseidon's honor, and thenceforth he would be free. "An oar," said Ulysses. "Yes," said the professor excitedly. "In the case of the great Ulysses, an oar, but in your case it would be something different, something pertinent to your story, to your years of wandering, something..." The professor began looking about. "Something like that." Bending over, Ulysses picked up the heavy piece of iron the professor had pointed to. "A spike," he said. "Yes," said the professor. "A spike. You must carry that to the place where someone is so unfamiliar with the railways that they ask you what it is, and on that spot, you should hammer it into the ground." When Wooly and Billy and Duchess were ready to leave, Professor Abernathy decided to stay behind in order to speak with Ulysses further. And just a few minutes after the three of them had gotten in the Cadillac, both Billy and Duchess had fallen asleep. So, as Wooly drove up the West Side Highway toward his sister's house, he had a moment to himself. If Wooly were perfectly honest, most of the time he'd rather not have a moment to himself. Moments with other people, he found, were much more likely to be filled with laughter and surprises than moments with oneself. And moments with oneself were more likely to circle inward towards some thought that one didn't want to be having in the first place. But on this occasion that he found himself with a moment to himself, Wooly welcomed it, because it provided him with the opportunity to revisit the day. He began at F.A.O. Schwartz, where he was standing in his favorite spot and his sister had suddenly appeared. And it was across the street to the plaza for old time's sake, where they had tea with the panda and retold some of the grand old stories. Upon parting with his sister, finding it to be a lovely day, Wooly had walked all the way to Union Square so he could pay his respects to Abraham Lincoln. Then it was off to the circus, and over the Brooklyn Bridge, and up the Empire State Building, where Professor Abernathy had bestowed upon Billy a book filled with blank pages in which to set down his adventures. Then Billy had taken them all to the overgrown elevated, where they had sat around the campfire and listened to the extraordinary exchange between Ulysses and the professor. But after that, after all of that, when it was finally time to go, and Ulysses had shaken Billy's hand and thanked him for his friendship, and Billy had wished Ulysses well on his quest to find his family, Billy had taken a pendant from around his neck. "This," he said to Ulysses, "is the medal of St. Christopher, the patron saint of travelers. It was given to me by Sister Agnes before our journey to New York, but I think that you should have it now." And then, so that the medal could be hung around his neck, Ulysses knelt before Billy, just as the members of the Round Table had knelt before King Arthur in order to be knighted. "When you put it," said Wooly to no one but himself, while wiping a tear from the corner of his eye, "when you put it all together just like that, with the beginning at the beginning, the middle in the middle, and the end at the end, there is no denying that today was a one-of-a-kind kind of day." 3. Wooly. "Coriander," said Wooly to himself with enthusiasm. For while Duchess was showing Billy how to properly stir a sauce, Wooly had set about alphabetizing the spice rack, and it didn't take long for him to discover just how many spices began with the letter C. In the entire rack, there was only one that started with the letter A. Allspice, whatever that was, and allspice was followed by just two spices that began with the letter B, basil and bay leaves.
But once Wooly moved on to spices that began with the letter C, well, it seemed there was no end to them. So far, there had been cardamom, cayenne, chili powder, chives, cinnamon, cloves, cumin, and now coriander. It certainly made one wonder. Perhaps, thought Wooly, perhaps it was like the matter of the W's at the beginning of questions. At some point in ancient times, the letter C must have seemed particularly suitable to the naming of spices. Or maybe it was at the same place in ancient times. Some place where the letter C had more sway over the alphabet. All of a sudden, Wooly seemed to remember from one of his history classes that many moons ago, there had been something called the spice route, a long and arduous trail along which tradesmen traveled in order to bring the spices of the East to the kitchens of the West. He even remembered a map with an arrow that arced across the Gobi Desert and over the Himalayas until it touched down safely in Venice, or some such spot. That the sea spices originated on the other side of the globe struck Wooly as a clear possibility, since he didn't even know what half of them tasted like. He knew cinnamon, of course. In fact, it was one of his favorite flavors. Not only was it used in the making of apple and pumpkin pie, it was the sine qua non of the cinnamon bun. But cardamom, cumin, and coriander? These mysterious words struck Wooly as having a distinctly oriental ring. Aha! Said Wooly, when he discovered the bottle of curry hiding behind the rosemary in the second-to-last row of the rack. For curry was most certainly, definitely, a flavor from the East. Making some space, Wooly tucked the curry beside the cumin. Then he turned his attention to the very last row, running his fingers along the labels of the oregano and the sage and the... What in the world are you doing there? Wooly wondered to himself. But before he could answer his own question, Duchess was asking another. Where did he go? Looking up from the spice rack, Wooly discovered Duchess in the doorway with his hands on his hips, and Billy nowhere to be seen. I turned my back for 1 minute, and he abandons his post. It was true, thought Wooly. Billy had left the kitchen despite having been put in charge of stirring the sauce. He hasn't gone back to that goddamn clock, has he? Asked Duchess. Let me investigate. Quietly, Wooly headed down the hallway and peeked into the living room, where, in fact, Billy had returned to the grandfather clock. Earlier that morning, when Billy had asked when Emmett would arrive, Duchess had replied with a great deal of confidence that he would be there in time for supper, which was to be served at 8 o'clock on the dot. Normally, this would have prompted Billy to take an occasional glance at his army surplus watch, but the watch had been broken by Emmett on the freight train, so he really had no choice but to pay an occasional visit to the living room instead, where the hands on the grandfather clock now indicated, rather unambiguously, that it was 7:42. Wooly was tiptoeing back toward the kitchen in order to explain this to Duchess when the telephone rang. The phone! Wooly exclaimed to himself. Maybe it's Emmett! Making a quick detour into his brother-in-law's office, Wooly zipped around the desk and picked up the receiver on the very third ring. Hello, hello, he said with a smile. For a moment, Wooly's friendly greeting was met with silence. Then a question was posed in what could only be described as a sharply pointed voice. Who is this? The woman on the other end of the line wanted to know. Is that you, Wallace? Wooly hung up. For a moment, he stared at the phone. Then, plucking the receiver out of its cradle, he dropped it on the desk. What Wooly loved about the game of telephone was that a phrase coming out at the end of the line could be so very different from the phrase that had first gone in. It could be more mysterious, or surprising, or amusing. But when someone like his sister Caitlin spoke into an actual telephone, it did not come out even slightly more mysterious or surprising or amusing. It came out just as sharply pointed as it was at the start. On the desktop, the receiver began buzzing like a mosquito in a bedroom in the middle of the night. Wooly swept the phone into one of the drawers and closed it as best he could, what with the cord sticking out. Who was that? Asked Duchess when Wooly returned to the kitchen. Wrong number. Billy, who also must have been hoping it had been Emmett, turned to Duchess with a worried look. It is almost 8 o'clock, he said. Is it? Said Duchess, in a manner suggesting that 1 hour was much like the next. How's the sauce coming? Wooly asked. in hopes of changing the subject. Duchess held the stirring spoon out to Billy.
Why don't you give it a try?
After a moment, Billy took the spoon and dipped it in the pot.
It looks pretty hot, Wooly cautioned.
Billy nodded and blew carefully. When he put the spoon in his mouth, Wooly and Duchess leaned forward in unison, eager to hear the verdict. What they heard instead was the ding-dong of the doorbell. The three looked at one another. Then Duchess and Billy were off like a shot, the former down the hallway and the latter through the dining room door. Wooly smiled for a moment at the sight of it, but then he had a worrisome thought. What if this was another instance of Schrödinger's cat? What if the ringing of the bell initiated two different potential realities, such that if the door were opened by Billy, it would be Emmett who was standing on the stoop, while were it opened by Duchess, it would be a door-to-door salesman? In a state of scientific uncertainty and heightened anxiety, Wooly hurried down the hall. Duchess. When the new boys would arrive at St. Nick's, Sister Agnes would put them to work. If we are asked to apply ourselves to that which is before us, she would say, we are less likely to fret over that which is not. So when they showed up on the doorstep looking a little shell-shocked, a little shy, and generally on the verge of tears, she would send them to the dining room to put out the silverware for lunch. Once the tables were set, she'd send them to the chapel to lay out the hymnals in the pews. Once the hymnals were in place, there were towels to be collected, sheets to be folded, and leaves to be raked, until the new boys weren't the new boys anymore. And that's what I did with the kid. Why? Because breakfast wasn't even over before he was asking when his brother would arrive. Personally, I didn't expect Emmett to show up before noon. Knowing Charity, I figured he would have had his hands full until 2 in the morning. Assuming he slept until 11 and lingered under the covers, he might make it to Hastings-on-Hudson by 2 in the afternoon, at the earliest. To be on the safe side, I told Billy he'd be here for dinner.
What time is dinner?
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock on the dot? Asked Wooly.
On the dot, I confirmed. Nodding, Billy excused himself politely, paid a visit to the clock in the living room, and returned with the news that it was 10:02. The implication was plain enough. There were 598 minutes between now and his brother's promised arrival, and Billy intended to count every one of them. So as soon as Wooly started clearing the breakfast dishes, I asked Billy if he'd give me a hand. First, I brought him to the linen closet, where we picked out a fine tablecloth and spread it across the dining room table, taking care to ensure that it draped over the ends in equal measure. At the four places, we laid out linen napkins, each with a different flower embroidered on it. When we turned our attention to the hutch, and Billy observed it was locked, I observed that keys were rarely far from their escutcheons, and reached my hand into the tureen. Voila! With the hutch's doors open, out came the fine china plates for the appetizer, main course, and dessert. Out came the crystal for the water and wine. Out came the 2 candelabra and the flat black case that held the family silver. Having instructed Billy how to lay out the cutlery, I figured I'd have to tighten up his work once he was finished. But when it came to setting places, it turned out Billy was a natural. It looked like he had positioned each fork, knife, and spoon with his ruler and compass. As we stood back to admire our work, he asked if tonight was going to be a special dinner.
Exactly. Why is it a special dinner, Duchess?
Because it's a reunion, Billy. A reunion of the Four Musketeers. The kid broke out in a big smile over that one, but then his brow furrowed. With Billy Watson, there was never more than a minute between the smile and the furrow.
If it's a special dinner, what are we going to eat?
An excellent question. At the request of one Wooly Martin, we are going to have a little something known as fettuccine mio amore. And that, my friend, is as special as it gets. After getting Billy to write out a shopping list of all the ingredients we would need, we were off to Arthur Avenue, driving at a speed of 300 questions an hour.
What's Arthur Avenue, Duchess?
It's the main drag in the Italian section of the Bronx, Billy.
What's an Italian section?
It's where all the Italians live.
Why do all the Italians live in one place?
So they can mind each other's business.
What's a trattoria, Duchess? What's a paisano? What's an artichoke and pancetta and tiramisu?
When we returned a few hours later, it was too early to start cooking. So having confirmed that Billy's mathematics were up to snuff, I took him into Wooly's brother-in-law's office to do a little accounting. Seating him at the desk with a pad and pencil, I lay down on the rug and rattled off all the expenses that Wooly and I had racked up since leaving St. Nick's. The 6 tanks of gas, the room and board at 2 Howard Johnson's, the beds and towels at the Sunshine Hotel, and the 2 meals at the diner on 2nd Avenue. To be on the safe side, I had him add an extra 20 for future outlays, then tally the whole list under the heading of operational expenses. Once we recovered Wooly's trust from the Adirondacks, these costs were to be reimbursed to Emmett before a single dollar was divvied. In a separate column under the heading of personal expenses, I had Billy include the long-distance call to Selena, the $10 for Bernie at the Sunshine Hotel, the bottle of whiskey for Fitzy, the champagne and companionship at Ma Bell's, and the tip for the doorman at the Empire State Building. Since none of these outlays were essential to our shared endeavor, I figured they should come out of my end. At the last second, I remembered the expenditures on Arthur Avenue. You could argue that they belonged under the operational expenses, since we'd all be eating them together. But with an, ah, what the hell, I told Billy to put them in my column. Tonight, dinner was on me. Once Billy had all the numbers down and he double-checked his sums, I encouraged him to take out a fresh sheet of paper and transcribe the 2 tallies. At a suggestion like that, most kids would have wanted to know why after doing the job once, they had to do it all over again. But not Billy. With his instinctive preference for the neat and tidy, he took out a new piece of paper and began duplicating his work with the same precision that he had laid out the forks and knives. When he was finished, Billy nodded his head 3 times, giving the tally his patented seal of approval. But then his brow furrowed.
"Shouldn't it have a title, Duchess?"
"What did you have in mind?" Billy thought about it for a second while biting the end of his pencil. And after writing it out in big capital letters, he read,
"The Escapade."
Now, how do you like that? When the expense report was finished, it was after 6 o'clock. Time to start cooking. After laying out the ingredients, I taught Billy everything that Lou, the chef at Leonello's, had taught me. First, how to make a basic tomato sauce from canned tomatoes and a sofrito.
"What's a sofrito, Duchess?"
Once that was on the stove, I showed him how to properly dice the bacon and properly slice the onion. Taking out a saucepan, I showed him how to properly sauté them together with the bay leaves, how to simmer them in white wine with oregano and pepper flakes, and finally, how to stir in 1 cup of the tomato sauce and not a teaspoon more. "The important thing now," I explained, "is to keep an eye on it, Billy. I've got to go to the washroom, so I want you to stand right where you are and occasionally give it a stir. All right?"
"All right, Duchess."
Handing Billy the spoon, I excused myself and headed for Dennis's office. Having said that I didn't think Emmett would be there by 2, I thought for sure that he'd be here by 6. After quietly closing the door, I dialed Ma Bell. It took her 20 rings to answer, but after giving me an earful about the etiquette of calling someone while they're in the middle of their bath, she brought me up to speed. "Uh-oh," I said as I hung up the phone. Having done 1 accounting with Billy, I found myself doing another on my own. With Emmett already a little peeved about the Studebaker, I'd hoped to make it up to him by giving him the night with charity. But clearly that hadn't gone as planned. How was I supposed to know that Wooly's medicine was so strong? Then to top it all off, I'd forgotten to leave an address. Yep, I thought to myself, there is a distinct possibility that when Emmett arrives, he'll be in a bad mood. Assuming, that is, that he can find us. Returning to the kitchen, I discovered Wooly staring at the spice rack and no one tending the sauce. That's when things began to accelerate. First, Wooly went off on reconnaissance. Then the telephone rang and Billy reappeared. Then Wooly returned with word of a wrong number, Billy announced it was nearly 8, and the doorbell rang. "Please, oh please, oh please," I said to myself as I dashed down the hall. With my heart in my mouth and Billy hot on my heels, I swung the door open. And there was Emmett, in a clean set of clothes, looking only a little worse for wear.
Before anyone had a chance to speak, the clock in the living room began to chime the hour of 8. Turning to Billy, I stuck out my arms and said, "What'd I tell you, kid?"